listening to TBR Radio, brought to you by the Barnes Review.
I'm talking to you.
Now, the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show with your host, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock.
Hello, everybody. And coming back today is one of my most regular guests who's become a very, very good friend of mine, and that is Michael Walsh. So I'm going to bring him up now. Mike, are you with me?
I'm very much with you, and I'm always with you on the air or off the air. It's nice to be with you again.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we're going to do today, it's an article that I did recently, and it's I'm going to read it through first. Now, it's relatively short, so I'm going to read it through, and there'll be a link to it in the post for the show. So here we go. I'm going to start off now. USA population projected to decrease 81% by 2025 from 320 million to 61 million. The website Deagle.com, which describes itself as a guide to military equipment and civil aviation, contains an interesting page entitled List of Countries Forecast 2025. On that page you will see a list of countries with projections in 2025 of their population, gross domestic product, GDP, military expenditures, and power purchase parity. Number 11 in the list on the first page is the United States of America, where in 2025 their projected population is 61,169,180, an 81% decrease. Their GDP shows a 95% decrease and their military spending a 99% decrease. Number 10 in the list, Germany, shows a 50% decrease in their population, a 69% decrease in their GDP, and a 76% decrease in their military spending. Number 26 in the list, South Africa, shows a 10% decrease in their population, a reduction of 5,202,800. Interestingly, the Statistics South Africa Census 2011 showed that there were about 4,586,838 white people in South Africa, amounting to 8.9% of the country's population. I then provide a link to the Deagle.com page listing these figures. If you scroll down to the bottom of this page, you will see that there are five supplementary pages, numbered 2 to 6. Let's click on page 2. Number 40 in the list, the United Kingdom, shows a 70% decrease in their population, a 92% decrease in their GDP, and a 97% decrease in their military spending. Number 31 in the list, Spain, shows a 51% decrease in their population, a 72% decrease in their GDP, and a 90% decrease in their military spending. Number 31 in the list, Sweden, shows a 40% decrease in their population, a 60% decrease in their GDP, and a 64% decrease in their military spending. I now find a link to the Deagle.com page listing these figures. The full six pages covers 180 of the 196 countries in the world. Interestingly, North Korea is one of the countries not listed, yet South Korea is. At the bottom of each of these pages is an explanation from Deagle.com dated October 26, 2014, advising how they estimated these figures. I present selections from their explanation below. In the past, especially in the 20th century, the key factor that allowed the USA to rise to its colossus status was immigration, with the benefits of a demographic expansion supporting the credit expansion and the brain drain from the rest of the world benefiting the states. The collapse of the Western financial system will wipe out the standard of living of its population whilst ending Ponzi schemes such as the stock exchange and the pension funds. The population will be hit so badly by a full array of bubbles and Ponzi schemes that the migration engine will start to work in reverse, accelerating itself due to ripple effects, thus leading to the demise of the states. This unseen situation for the states will develop itself in a cascade pattern with unprecedented and devastating effects for the economy. Jobs offshoring will surely end, with many American corporations relocating overseas, thus becoming foreign corporations. We see a significant part of the American population migrating to Latin America and Asia, while migration to Europe, suffering a similar illness, won't be relevant. Nevertheless, the death toll will be horrible. When pensioners see their retirement disappear in front of their eyes and there are no servicing jobs, you can imagine what is going to happen next. At least younger people can migrate. Never in human history were so many elders among the population. In past centuries, people were lucky to get to their 30s or 40s. A confluence of crisis with a devastating result. I believe there may be something more sinister afoot here, though. An 81% decrease in the American population within 8 years due to a financial collapse and nothing else. On that basis, I will leave the last word to Deagle.com and suggest you, the reader, be the judge. The majority of the economic and demographic data used in making of the forecasts is widely available by institutions such as the CIA, the IMF, the UN, USG, etc. Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, May the 9th, 2017. Now, the reason that Mike is so perfect to have on this show is he's written a book, and we've actually done a show on it, called Megacaust. And Mike is an expert on how governments have killed their own citizens. I think we're talking about 180, 190 million people in total over the last 100 years. So I'm going to bring Mike in now. Mike, could you give a rundown of Megacaust and the evidence that you put together, the countries that were affected in this slaughter of their own citizens, please?
Certainly, and I do think that you should be congratulated, Andrew, because I think this story is quite an exclusive, and I think that really it should go viral, not only throughout the United States, but throughout Europe, and indeed the world of ethnic Europeans. Now, the figures that you mention aren't plucked from a hat. What needs to be remembered is that governments, you may plan for the rest of the week, and in terms of holidays or financial matters, you may plan for the following year. But governments, even when they're building a warship, are thinking 10, 15, 20 years ahead. So what this report says about the future is perfectly understandable from a government restructuring point of view. And as for these figures, as I say, they're not figures plucked from the air. They do have a very good basis. And indeed, and this is what should alarm us all, is that we are not learning from history. And population reduction has been, by force, has been a matter of government policy for several hundred years. As a matter of fact, it may surprise quite a few people that Britain or England, whichever way you wish to call it, was the, they are the best at it. And there was, I often say, and people are a little bit taken aback by it, is basically there is nothing that Stalin did that England hadn't done before that. Now, I'm not talking as an Irishman who is anti-English or anything like that. I'm stating facts. You know, the Irish population was 4 million. It was reduced to 2 million. So there's a 50% reduction. You're just talking about an 81%. That's not a great deal of difference, comparatively speaking. Now, leaving Ireland alone, what we have to remember is that in the last 100 years, if you have just said, Andrew, is genocide, this is murder by government, has claimed the lives of 170 million martyrs during the 20th century alone. Now, these are not my figures. They were not written on the back of an envelope. The source is an American authoritative source. It's the R.J. Rummel Power, Genocide and Mass Murder, which is the Journal of Peace Research, which operates from Hawaii, which, of course, is a state of the United States. So such organizations like these are very, very well funded. And the authorities that are responsible for the raising of these analyzed figures are, they know what they're doing. They're very authoritative themselves. And when they say 170 million people have died as a consequence of deliberate government deliberations, then it's time that we all sat up and took note. And it has happened. You know, it has happened in Russia, for instance. Russia is a very good example. Now, anybody who listens to the opening of your show today, and they say that a 81% reduction is a little bit alarmist. You know, I wouldn't be surprised at all if many people were sceptical about that figure, 81%. But it's happened before, and it's happened time after time after time. It happened in Ireland. There was a huge percentage there. The Bengal famine, which, of course, two Bengal famines, both of which of them were artificial. You had the several Holodomors, we, most of us are aware of the Ukrainian so-called famine. It was not a famine at all. It was an artificial reduction of the population through starvation. What they did, Bolsheviks, backed by the United States, what they did is they starved to death a minimum, at least 25% of the Ukrainian population, which is 40 million. As a matter of fact, it was Stalin. Stalin's figures, not mine, in a conversation with Winston Churchill, the unelected Prime Minister of wartime Britain. He conceded that at least 10 million Ukrainians had died during just one famine. So it has to be remembered also that the same mindset, the same people, the same governing elite are still running things today. So, you know, it's irrelevant in a way that we're talking 1917, 1922, 1934, Bengal famine even earlier, Ireland. It really doesn't matter. Population control through population reduction, artificial, is a normal government policy. And let's face it, the United States has got too many mouths to feed. They're going to do something about it, and it can be done very quickly. We certainly within the 8 years. You were a little bit cynical, and I can understand that too, Andrew, about the reduction taking place over 8 years. Andrew, in the Rhine Meadows in 1945, all they did was herd surrendered German servicemen, women and children too, into huge barbed wire camps, very similar to your FEMA camps in the United States. And a month or so later, a million of them were dead. At least. Nobody knows the figures. Now, the human body can live for about 3 days, I believe, without some kind of fluid, water or something like that. It lasts a little bit longer without food. But if you deny a human being water, fluid in some form, you can guarantee. So, again, why did the Germans allegedly use gas chambers? Just put them in huge camps, do what the Americans did, put them into huge outdoor camps, put a barbed wire fence around it, put sentries, armed sentries around it, and in 3 days they're all gone. And it hasn't cost you a penny. You don't have to feed them. So, yes, it does happen. I'm sorry to go on and on, but, you know, I'm a European. I'm very concerned about our brothers and sisters in the United States, as I am in Europe here and in South Africa. And it really is 5 minutes to midnight for the ethnic Europeans and other people, incidentally.
Yes, and I really thank you for that excellent presentation there about how this has happened in the past. And I'm going to have a look at various different, you know, just give you some figures. I mean, number one on the list is China. That's got a reduction of only 1%. India's got an increase of 8%. Russia is largely untouched, a 2% reduction. Brazil, that goes up by 5%. I'm not going to go through each one individually, but I want to point out the, you know, countries of most interest at the moment in the world sphere. We've got France of a reduction of 31%, essentially, of course, you brought up Russia because and Ukraine, and we know that millions were slaughtered by the Bolshevik Jews in Russia, but they seem to be, with just a 2% reduction, you know, not really touched by whatever is facing us. And it makes me put my, you know, conspiratorial hat on, or maybe that's a bit of an unfair tag there, and more like geopolitical. I mean, what we see at the moment is we see the West, the United States, Britain, countries in the EU going against Russia, who are allied with China, who are allied with Syria, who are allied with North Korea, etc., etc. And these countries seem to be untouched, whereas our countries are getting really hit. So could there be anything, in your opinion, with regard to these figures? You made the statement that these countries plan for 10, 20 years ahead. Do you think, it seems to me, to that sort of reduction, when the writers of the website claim, oh, it's due to economic and all that, that's nonsense. Economic factors, I can't see that kind of, you know.
It's a matter of control, isn't it, Andrew? You know, the people, the countries that you list, they're not controlled by the Wall Street globalists. And, you know, that's the get-out-of-jail clause, so it's perfectly believable. And then the other thing is a simple sustainability. In Russia, you've got 8 time zones, and you've got a population of 144 million, which is very, very tiny. There is a comparison somewhere, and even the smallest Asian nations have more than 144 million. Now, the population of the United States, going off the top of my head, is about 3 times that of Russia. And yet, in a geographical size, so we're talking about sustainability here, the means to feed people, the United States, in actual fact, is a very, very small country. Now, that may sound a little bit surprising if you live in Fort Lauderdale in the south east of the country, and or in Seattle in the northwest of the country. You know, America seems to be a vast country, but let me tell you that if you were to drop the United States on Africa, it would just about cover the north part of Africa, you know, somewhere from Egypt, most of the Sahara Desert, but certainly nothing below the Sahara Desert. It would take up Morocco and little countries like that. But if you were to drop the United States onto Africa, it would make up about 20% of the African continent. So, I'm sorry, the United States geographically and in the means of sustaining its people is not a large country. If you were to drop the United States on Russia, you know, you would need your magnifying glass to see it. Now, with a country like the United States, which is geographically small compared with the likes of Russia and India and Latin America, though they do already have lots of lemons round, they have the room to expand. There is no feeding problem there. But when in the United States, in a comparatively tight area, you have 400 mouths to feed, that's nearly half a billion, then you have you have troubles ahead. And the only way to avoid that trouble, and it will come, is to get rid of the what the governing elite regard as the parasites. These are the people who, for various reasons, age obviously is one of them, are unable to practice an independent life, to be self-sustaining. These will go, no question about it, and they will go very, very simply. I hope that at some time we can at least touch upon the topic of economic collapse, because this is a word we hear in the United States, in the newspapers. We see it in the newspapers, we hear it on the television, the radio, but it doesn't really mean anything to us. It means a reduction in our, you know, what we buy and that sort of thing. It is not. Now, if you look up, they've removed it for some reason, but Argentina went through a period of economic collapse, I seem to recall, going on memory, about 2002, 2004. And this was a very, very prosperous country. It was a country that had a wonderful middle class. If anything, it could be described as very much the equal to the United States in terms of prosperity and their lifestyle, comfort and security. All of these boxes were ticked by Argentina. And then all of a sudden, the globalists pulled the plug on it. The same globalists who were running the United States, by the way. They pulled the plug on Argentina. Now, I'll tell you what happened, because it happens, and it happens time after time, Andrew, is that you've got so much put aside, your nest egg, as you call it. You've got something in the bank. You've got something in your property. and you might have something under the pillow. I hope you do, because if it's in the bank, you're not going to be able to get it. Because when you have an economic collapse, is you hear the news reports and the gathering hysteria, you're aware of it, and when you walk outside of your door, you know that there is change, you instinctively know that there is change, but you can't quite put your finger on it. But then you walk down to your local neighbourhood bank, and it's a little bit unusual because we're talking mid-Tuesday morning, but there's a queue outside, and it's a long queue. And you've only got to look at the faces of the people in the queue. They're drawn, they're haggard, they're terrified. Some of them are weeping. And the reason that they're weeping is that the bank is closed. So they go to the hole in the wall to make a withdrawal so that they can pay the rent, pay the utilities. It's all closed down. It's all gone. It's all gone. With what little money they may have, the money that is under the pillow, they rush to the supermarket in the car. It might be one of the last trips they ever make in the motor car because petrol will be rationed. And when they get to the supermarket, they'll find that virtually the shelves have been emptied. And so if they don't know the means of growing their own or killing their own, as I did when I was a child, then I'm sorry, but their lifespan has gone down from about 20 years to about 20 days.
Yes, and I'm pleased that you brought that up because while you were reading that, I went onto a website because I wanted to know what the federal debt was in America per person, because we know at the moment it's around 20 trillion. Well, I've got figures from February 2016. It says federal debt just exceeded $19 trillion, and that's $58,000 for each person in the United States. Now, if you think talking to the listeners now, how much you could have on, say, a credit card before you were bankrupted, you wouldn't be able to get away with $58,000. But that's what each of these people are saddled with. And so it may be time that they're just going to cull a load of people. And the other point that I'd like to raise is, what exactly do any of the countries, the white nations that I've mentioned, produce? Well, it's all service-based economy. All the manufacturing is done in places like China and India that are going to experience either little change or growth. This is the situation as I see it, that it could, this outsourcing, this, moving manufacturing to countries with cheaper labour, it's all been part of this plan to give us absolutely no means of survival when they pull the plug, because we won't have a manufacturing base. We won't have factories we can turn to and start producing our own goods. We don't have a population capable of doing it. I mean, I remember when I was younger, girls would do needlework classes. They'd be taught things like that. You had classes like home economics, which was basically teaching you how to cook and things like that. That's all been taken out of schools. Now they're too busy teaching you diversity. But the reason that they don't teach you anything that could, woodwork was a class for boys. And it was teaching you how to make things, and so essentially you could be self-sufficient. They don't want you to be self-sufficient, not because simply they want you to buy all their products, although that is one reason. They don't want you to make your own food. They want you to buy their GM ready meals. But at the same time, I think that they're just making money there like they always do, this group of usual suspects. But the actual end game is to make us unable to fend for ourselves when they pull the plug. What are your thoughts on that, Mike?
Yeah, plenty of thoughts on it. I remember about 20 years ago, there were the dreamers who said, well, if machines and computers are going to take over the jobs of men and women, this is going to mean a lot of unemployed, unless the capitalists are kind enough to feed us and give us our holidays, in other words, to pay us while we're not working. Now, this may seem far-fetched, but about 20 years ago, I went to a printing firm in Keighley in West Yorkshire, and I was having a chat with the chap who owned the printing business, and he showed me a machine, which I think you would describe as, I don't know if you have Ford Transit vans in the United States. You're talking about a small van, small vehicle for moving, you know, home, perhaps. We're not talking about a Pantechnicon or anything like that. Something about three times the size of an average motor car. And he said, do you see this machine? Now, this particular company, what they did is they specialized in holiday and hotel brochures. You've all seen them. They're A4 in size. They fold twice. They flip over. And they're in full color. You know, they're everywhere. Wherever you go into a tourist office or wherever you go, these marketing pamphlets, flyers are there. That's what they specialized in. And he told me that 10 years earlier, to produce these flyers, with the range of colours and the other expertise that they were needing, would need, I seem to recall he said 36 men. And they were all, many of them were experts in the machines, all of the various printing machines and the colour operations and the binding and all the rest of it. And these were 36 highly skilled men. He said, you see this machine there? He said, it does exactly the same as those 35 men did. And he said, it only takes one man to operate it. It runs on its own. He says, if there is a marginal colour difference, which is too faint for the human eye to spare to see, he said, the machine will pick it up, it will identify it, and the man will make a small correction, and off it goes again, automatically. So I said, well, what's happened to the other 35 men? He said, well, you tell me. So that's 35 men unemployed. They were all specialists at their job. Now, I'm Liverpool born and bred, despite my Irish nationality, and I'm very proud of the city, the maritime city of Liverpool. And it was the second city of empire, Andrew. And the dockers, the stevedores, they're called in the United States, you know, they were like ants in an anthill. You know, there were tens of thousands of them. Right up through the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s. And then I heard that the population of the stevedores in Liverpool had just disappeared, totally evaporated. There was none there. There was none there. There's no need to be there. And the reason is again, technology. Now a huge ship, incidentally, a ship of 100,000 tons, which is 15 times the size of the ships that I used to sail on in the 1960s, 15 times that size, would be in the dock, wherever the dock was. It could be Portland in the United States. Wherever that dock was, that ship would be in there for several days while stevedores crawled all over it and emptied it. You'll have to excuse me. I've got hay fever, so if I sneeze... do excuse me.
No problem.
And but now these huge carriers come into the likes of Liverpool and Portland in Oregon and New York, Manhattan, everywhere else. They come in. They weigh 15 times the size of the ships that I used to sail on, and they're in and out in a matter of hours. It's cranes that just come in and pick the containers up, you know, like you plucking grapes from the vine. It's that simple, and they're gone in a few hours. The ships, although they're 15 times bigger, they still have a crew round about the same, 15 or 20 people. So they haven't gone up in size. So there's no unemployment. There's no employment there. And the Liverpool docks, believe it or not, and I'm pretty sure that this, I'm speaking for all of the other docklands, wherever in the world you are, the Liverpool docks was, so vast. As I say, it was called the second city of empire. It fed the empire. There is more cargo being shifted through Liverpool today than it was during the period when it was the second city of empire. Now, theoretically, we should have something like 100,000 dockers, stevedores, who are operating those docks. There isn't. I doubt there is 1,000. So what happened to the other 99,000 stevedores? You tell me. They're superfluous to requirements. I'm sorry to say it. We can talk about that, about the contents of your cupboard, Andrew, or the contents of my fridge, Andrew. But we could say that these eggs or this bread is surplus to requirements. But when you are government, you're talking about them discussing people as being surplus to requirements. And how are we going to deal with the problem in the United States of 300 million parasites? That's their problem. It's your problem too, because you may be deemed to be one of their parasites.
Yes, and it's interesting because we hear these stories of robots replacing humans. We hear self-driving cars will be a reality within 10 years. Amazon has been testing drones to deliver parcels rather than a postal system. And the other country just off the list, number 69, page 3, we're on Greece. Of course, that is the main country that we hear about in the European Union that's had all these problems. We know that Cyprus actually did a bank bail-in. But Greece, they've got projected population decrease of 55%. And so, you know, there's certainly an economic side to this, but I don't think that it's the economic side alone. I think that they will literally be in a situation where, as you say, Mike, I mean, we've heard about these FEMA camps in America for years, and it's got to a stage where people don't really do shows about the FEMA camps or talk about them anymore because it's like, well, they're there, but they've not done anything with them. So we don't really know what they're for, but there's, you know, hundreds of them across America, these massive great things that, as you say, are set out in the same way as the camps were for the German men, women and children after the end of the Second World War. They're the same structure.
It's an American gulag.
Yeah.
It's all in preparation. I forget now how many gulags there were. It's something like 1,035 or something. You'll probably have a similar number of FEMA camps in the United States. That's what they're there for. All of a sudden, for the most minor of offences, it might be just a motoring offence in the high street in some obscure American town, is you'll go before the beak and you'll be sentenced to 30 for 3 months or something like that. But that's irrelevant. Because in the life expectancy in these camps will be very, very low. Now, you do have a particular problem in the United States, and that's a multiracial problem. In Russia, when they had the Gulag, as I say, over 1,000 camps scattered around the Soviet Union, then virtually, well, everybody in there was a fellow Russian. So if there was 20,000 people working on a project, one of Stalin's five-year plans, canal or something grandiose, all paid for by the United States, by the way, then at least you lived and you died, you know, with fellow Russians. But in the United States, you have a particular problem, is that the whites are now officially a minority. And when your wife is picked up for a minor motoring offence, they're not going to segregate her when they put her in one of these camps. You know, your wife could find herself, you know, sharing a barracks type of setting, you know, where she is one of five females in a camp, holding in each particular hut, for instance, 100 non-whites. So, you know, work it out for yourself. You don't need me to spell it out for you, do you? Will she survive 3 months? I doubt it very much.
Yes, and a figure that I should have really put in the report is Ireland, and they've got a projected 68% decrease in population. And of course, that's not something that will be unfamiliar to them historically, as you pointed out in this show, Mike.
No, the population reduction of my national country, Ireland, has been going on since the 16th century. Irish were used as slaves, bartered as slaves by the English before the Africans were. And in some ways, much of the United States and, you know, the Caribbean was peopled and worked by Irish slaves. And the population many, many years ago was 4 million, so it had to be reduced somewhere because as far as London was concerned, they couldn't feed themselves. Neither could the English, by the way, so not being anti-English. They were as brutal to the English people as they were to the Irish. You weren't singled out because you were Irish. You know, if a maid in the early 18th century, about 1720, no, about 1800, if she was caught being a little bit light-fingered and sticking on, taking her madam, her boss's clothes or something like that, she would be deported. And some of them were sold to African slave traders, some whites. English were sold to African slave traders. So the colour of your skin just doesn't come into it from these people's point of view. If you're a slave, then off you go. And this is the way the population will be reduced. And statistically, we're taking the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR, as an example. But I tell you, it will actually happen in the United States, socialist states, if you like. In the Gulag, these scattered camps, work camps, and grandiose five-year plans in Bolshevik-occupied Russia, life expectancy was 4 million. Four months. Now, you were uneconomic if you survived for more than 4 months, because, there were queues behind you. You were a bed blocker, if you like. In hospital terms, you were a bed blocker. They were harvesting so many new prisoners throughout the Soviet Union that if people were to, for some reason, be better fed or work less hard in the Gulag, and the life expectancy went from 4 million, for 4 months, keep on saying 4 million, from 4 months to 6 months, then this caused a backlog problem. Imagine, for instance, you're a Ford Motor Company and the workers are producing 60,000 cars every month. You can't sell 60,000 cars every month. So scattered around the area of the factory, you've got your cars piling up, the unsold cars. Now, what they normally do is they cause a strike. So everybody goes home without pay, they go on strike, and when the number of cars have been reduced to a working level, then the bosses settle the strike, and everybody goes back to work, and everybody's happy. You know, the worker has got about 5 cents per hour more, and the boss has reduced his superfluous to requirements car. They do the same with the people. You know, this people are just units, and people have got to realize this. You know, my name is Michael Walsh. Mike Walsh, your name is Andrew Carrington Hitchcock. But to them, you're a number, and that's all you are. You're a number. Sorry, everybody is.
Yes, and sorry about that. I was just filling up my glass with water just as you stopped there, Mike. I'm going to run through now the... Well, I mentioned China. Now, that's got a 1% decrease, so that's basically unchanged. I'm going to go through the countries, not all of them, but they're actually listed. The order that they list them in is by highest population. So I'll go through a few that obviously people will be familiar with as well. But these are the ones that are going to experience a population growth, albeit these population growths aren't particularly... I mean, they're not growing by 81% in the way that the USA is declining by 81%. It's nothing like that. The most, I don't think they even hit... I mean, India here is getting an 8% increase. But these are the countries that they say are going to increase their population. And see if you can see the pattern here. India, Brazil, Mexico, Indonesia, Malaysia, Colombia, Philippines, Pakistan, Chile, Vietnam. Let's go on to page 2. Venezuela. Of course, there's lots of problems in Venezuela at the moment. People are starving out there. They seem to think that they're going to get a population increase. Bangladesh, Peru, Algeria, Kazakhstan, Morocco, Sri Lanka, Myanmar, Ecuador. Are there any white countries in there, Mike? I know that there's white populations in places like Chile, because I've had Alex Van Houten on my show, and he's... says that there's, you know, big white enclaves in Chile and Argentina, etc. But, you know, what are your thoughts on these countries I've just read?
Well, I do think one thing needs to be raised. We're talking about a 1% population increase in China. Now, the natural population increase over the same period of time would normally be a lot higher. So it's still a reduction, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
You know, by many tens of millions, because they have a population well over a billion, of course. As does India. But one of the things that strikes me as you are going through these countries is they've all got, as the Germans call it, they've got elbow room, Lebensraum. So they have got a place to grow. You don't have it in the United States. You certainly don't have it in Britain that has a population. And the population of Britain, I think, is around about 74 million. Now, most of these are crammed into England. You know, you can drive for hour after hour in Scotland and never see another vehicle. you know, so England, Scotland, if you look at Scotland on the map, it appears to be roughly the size of Ireland, almost the size of England, and yet the population is neither here nor there. I think most of them live in Glasgow or Edinburgh, and then that's it. The rest is, you know, it's just wasteland, if you like, moors and mountains and lakes. And Wales is very, very similar. It's very much underpopulated. So the 70 million mostly live in England. Now, England just cannot sustain those kind of numbers for very long. You have quite rightly pointed out that people need to work to sustain themselves. If there isn't the work, how are they going to sustain themselves? If you think that the government is going to look after you, then go and have a look at the Indian reservations in the United States. That's how the government looks after you. You will be abandoned in such camps, and this will cause population reduction. So, but the countries that you mentioned, they benefit from two ways. You know, they've got lots of space to be utilized, to be exploited. Places like Ecuador, they are large countries. Yes, they do have a wide population. As a matter of fact, Ecuador, Uruguay, Paraguay, Argentina, and the other country that you mentioned was Chile. These are all penciled into my diary as possible places to flee to when, not if, when the economic collapse occurs. I just hope that I have enough money in the bank at the time for me and my wife to book one-way tickets to these Latin American countries, or perhaps Thailand in the Southeast Asia, because I think that these will be largely untouched. Tough on you guys who can't afford it.
How about somewhere like Russia, Mike? Because, of course, they've got probably the largest white population, and they look largely untouched, although they experience a slight decrease. And as you say, there should be an overall increase because of, you know, general population growth. So they are going to be hit in some way. But you said as well that they've got such a huge landmass, there's plenty of expansion there. Is that somewhere that would appeal to you, or would you rather go the Latin American route?
I would rather go the Latin American route for several reasons. You know, English is widely spoken in Latin America, and it's not in Russia. It's 4% of Russians speak English, and they're mostly in places like Moscow and St. Petersburg, the large cities. But you've got a different problem, a totally different problem from, say, the United States in the 19th century. There was a desperate need for, you know, lots of immigrants to build the new system, the new state. So the peoples of Europe were being vacuumed up through Ellis Island, if you like. You know, that was needed. But the problem with Russia today is the economy is vibrant simply because it is tightly controlled. And the only thing that would rock the boat is an influx of desperate people who can't speak the language. Now, I have a lot of Russian friends. I have Ukrainian friends and people like that. And they say, how can I get to Spain? How can I get to the European Union? I say, well, unless you can speak the language of the country that you're going to fluently, you can forget it. You know, it just isn't going to happen. I had a friend who came to Spain where English is widely spoken, and she was the product of two universities, Andrew. She could speak fluently, conversationally, in six languages, yet she couldn't find a job in the most vibrant part of Spain, which was Andalusia, Marbella, Costa del Sol. She couldn't get a job there, and the unemployment rate here in Spain, which is part of the European Union, of course, is 20%. It's just under 20% at 19.2%. But the unemployment rate, and it's not likely to recover simply because all of the jobs that were traditionally there for the young men and the young women leaving the colleges and the schools, they've all evaporated. So it's not going to, you're not going to get a country where the employment rate, unemployment rate, is lower than 12%. It just isn't going to happen. It could happen in the 30s or the 40s. It would certainly happen in Germany during the 1930s. They were encouraging American Germans to come home because they needed them in the factories and elsewhere, in the offices, in the hospitals, everywhere else. There was a desperate need for them. That is all gone. Russia is not the Third Reich. It is not the Workers' Reich. So if, for instance, let's knock 30, 40 years off my, my age, and I was to go there with my wife, so I'm going to struggle because I don't know the language, I don't know the culture, and Russia, bless them, are going to have difficulty with me because what are they going to do with me? I've got to feed myself, I've got to clothe myself, I've got to live somewhere, I'm going to use the utilities, I've got to have the means of sustaining a living. There simply isn't. What they have is controlled growth. It isn't the kind of growth that you had in the Workers' Reich in the 1930s. You have a controlled growth, and that is why they can't. They've already accommodated, thanks to Washington, D.C., the ruinous foreign policies. The Russians, bless them, are already they're the host of 1.4 million Ukrainians who have fled their own country because of its shortcomings due to the regime that has been installed by Washington, D.C. Now, another 500,000 Ukrainians are living in Poland, and we can presume that something in the region of 2 to 2.5 million Ukrainians are scattered throughout the European Union. They are unable to go home simply because there aren't the jobs there. There's nothing to sustain them. And if they're young men, by which I mean under 55 years of age, then they are eligible for conscription. So if back over the border they go straight into an army uniform. This is the debacle that Ukraine has become. Now, when that happens to Germany, France, Italy, Spain, that is when you're going to get the topic of your program today is massive reduction of population. It will be forced upon us.
Yes, and it's interesting because the figures for Ukraine that you mentioned is a 22% decrease, and Poland is only an 8% decrease. But another couple of countries I should have mentioned, I'm sorry, because I've got many listeners over there, and that's Australia, a 49% decrease, and New Zealand, a 26% decrease. And the main reason for bringing up those figures is what I've said in the past when I've been talking about my article, Jewish Genocide of the White Race, Case Closed, Parts 1 and 2, is countries as far apart as European white countries in Europe, Australia, New Zealand, and then you go right over to America. It's all these white populations that they are obsessed with pumping diversity into. And as we can see from this list, these nations scattered all across the globe are somehow, for some reason, going to experience this great reduction in population. And what you said about the UK being unable to sustain itself currently, Mike, of course, we've still got mass immigration coming into the country. And I've seen several stories on mainstream news that are talking about how they need to relax the restrictions on building on Greenbelt land because we've got so many people coming into the country. Well, you don't let them into the country. It's very simple. And I've had people on the show discuss this issue. And the only solution can be that your own government is doing this to get rid of you, to basically reduce your quality of life, because you can't keep moving
down the wine.
Sorry, Mike?
You're watering down the wine.
Yeah, exactly. It's and the only solution, if you just take the glasses off and you just think to yourself, right, don't think about anything that they're saying, the way that they're tickling your ears with this nonsense. Oh, we have to do this. Oh, the children, all unaccompanied minors, refugees, all this utter garbage. And actually say, Does it make sense to keep bringing people into a country, many of which can't even work, don't know the language? Well, no, it doesn't make sense. So they are obviously here for another reason. And what I say is that the people that they're bringing in are going to be part of the race war that's coming up, because these people don't assimilate to our way of life. They bring their own religions, like the Muslim faith, with them, and they refuse to adapt to our beliefs. And so in the end, that can only result in conflict. And because they kind of, like you said earlier, Mike, I mean, they grew up in a harder life, you know. They weren't didn't have this sugar-coated lifestyle that the children in the UK have, and they go to school, and, you know, if the mother doesn't earn enough, they get benefits and all this. The countries that they've come from, they've had to fend from being children, because that's the way that life should be. You shouldn't have children unless you can afford to keep them, and you should go out to work in order to make your living. It's the white nations have got it all back to front and saying, oh, if someone can't work, we pay them money, we give them benefits, all these different things. It's nonsense. And I think that therefore, in a potential race war with all these, you know, social justice warriors, what are they going to do against a load of bloodthirsty Muslims, that many of which have been brought up in, you know, shacks, if that, yeah. You know? Yeah. Who's going to win in a fight?
The white race has been cosseted, and it's going to be the death sentence, because even in one generation, now I am one generation, even in one generation, I was, you know, spent most of my childhood in Wales, and without going into the detail, I would say that 90% of what was on our table, breakfast, dinner, and lunch, was either grown by ourselves or it was hunted locally. If it wasn't killed by my stepfather, then it was killed by the local poacher or the gamekeeper or something like that. But something like 80 or 90% of the food that was consumed by our family of seven, mum and dad and five children, was homegrown, and it was either grown in the fields or the gardens or it was killed. Now, I would say that of my, we're talking about the average family now, I would say that virtually everything in their cupboard, in their freezer, in their fridge, and on their table at the end of the day, none of it is homegrown, and much of it simply couldn't be cooked, because it comes to the table ready cooked. All you've got to do is put it in the microwave. But what are you going to do when there isn't any electricity, when you haven't got a fireplace or anything of that? So the white ethnic community, which has been cosseted since I was a child, are going to find themselves at a great disadvantage to the generations of third world immigrants who, like I did, my generation did in the 1950s and 1960s, they are survivors, and they will survive in a hostile environment much easier than today's ethnic Europeans will.
That's an excellent point, and you put it so eloquently. And that is exactly, it's great to do a show like this, Mike, and literally put the pieces together while we're talking. This isn't scripted, folks. We're, you know, I found this document, and I said to Mike before the show, you know, this is one source here. Now, we can't base the future on one source that is, you know, you look at the write-up and they don't really say who they are or where they're from. But then you have to think about it and say, well, when you look at these pages, they've gone through 180 countries and they've spent time thinking of figures for the four different categories, going through each one. They've got the write-up at the bottom. When I sent this article to Mike yesterday, and he read it, he liked it because it fitted right in with, you know, his work with Megacorst and what have you. And it whilst it was quite a surprise to me, I'd heard about this before and it took me a while to look it up. I had to actually go onto a different search engine than Google. I used DuckDuckGo and I found it then, but I couldn't find it on Google. So that raised a flag for me, any permutations that I type in. Now, if you type in Deagle 2025, it comes up on Google, but I think their search criteria, what they're doing is they're narrowing it, and so you have to be more and more specific to find what you're looking for. So, I mean, I didn't even know that, I didn't remember the name of the site was Deagle.com. So when I went to DuckDuckGo, it was a case of population reduction projections, you know, various permutations of that. But it really, the whole thing fits together. It's a case of joining the dots, really. It's, as we mentioned, the mass immigration, the FEMA camps, the push on diversity, as Mike said, the fact that these people can cope in a hostile environment and we've not been raised to do so. I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, folks, to actually see what is on the horizon. Now, Mike, we've only got 2 or 3 minutes left, so I'd like to hand back to you for anything else you want to say. Now, we can overrun if you would like, but what I want you to get out importantly is your website and details of how they can get your books, Mega Course, any other work you've got in the offing, anything that you'd like to promote, Renegade Tribune that you write for. Over to you, Mike. Please take us through that.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. Yes, you're absolutely right. I did a great deal of research, not just me, but my little helpers also, in compiling Megacost. And Megacost and Trotsky's White Negroes, both of which are available from spitfreehistory.com. Don't panic if you can't get onto it today, because it is linked to Renegade Tribune, and they are having to migrate to a far bigger server simply because Renegade Tribune has become so popular that it has outgrown the server that it had. So by the time this program is broadcast, which I believe is May the 23rd, there won't be a problem. There's not going to be a problem. So fine, forget what I've just said. Go on to spin3history.com. You will see the books there. You will see them on advertised on Renegade Tribune. And you will also see them from the May-June issue of the Barnes Review, because I have a half page of paid-for advertising in there. And the website is listed there, as is my address. And interestingly, Megacost and Trotsky's White Negroes, which support the entire thesis of the topic that, excuse me, that we've been talking about today, they are very, very popular. They make up a 25% of the 39 book titles that I have on sale. 25% of them are either Megacost or Trotsky's White Negroes. And interestingly, this is very important too, another 25% of the book's popularity scales, top of the pops, if you like, top of the books, is the African books. You know, Africa's Killing Fields, Rhodesia's Death, Europe's Funeral, and the Last Gladiators, which is about the civil uprisings in Africa. These are very popular because what is happening in South Africa and white Africa today is going to happen in the United States and in Europe tomorrow. Now, it is their death, but it is your funeral. Enjoy.
Thank you so much, Mike. And again, for the listeners, the website is spinfreehistory.com. It's always a delight to have you on, Mike, and I thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a great pleasure, Michael.
Thanks. Right, well, I hope enjoyed is probably the wrong word, but awakened. And I hope this show has awakened you to the prospects that we have ahead. And I want to thank everyone for listening. I'll be back with you all soon. And bye for now.
You have been listening to the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Show on TBR Radio, brought to you by the Barnes Review. Andrew's book, The Synagogue of Satan, is now available on his website, andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com, in an updated, expanded, and uncensored edition.